We're going to have to just talk about your age and where you came from and how many of your folks were involved in racing and how you got involved in racing. What are some of the highlights in racing? Testing. 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm here today, March the 21st, on this brisk March morning, interviewing one of my best friends, John Lee Robinson. John Lee Robinson is a native of Louisville and has been involved in horse racing for many years. And I regard him as one of the leading authorities in horse racing. Sometimes people who have a lot of fame, get a lot of notoriety and publicity, are people whose names get in the paper a lot. But this morning we're interviewing someone who's recently been very successful, but whom I consider to be a successful horseman. Good morning.
Morning.
Would you give us your name?
My name is John Lee Robinson.
Could you tell us where you were born?
I was born in Louisville, Kentucky.
What year?
1943.
What section of Louisville did you grow up in?
I was born in the South Louisville area.
South Louisville area.
Yes.
Is that the Highland Park area?
Highland Park area.
Right. How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I have four sisters. I'm the only boy.
Oh, you're the only boy.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. And you went to school in
School in Louisville, Kentucky. I went to Jackson Junior High. I went to Central, which I dropped out 11th grade.
11th grade.
Yeah.
How did you get interested in horse racing?
I was born and raised in the area where a racetrack was named Douglas Park.
Oh, out of the old Douglas Park there.
Yeah. I had two uncles of which worked with horses, and they carried me to the track when I was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old.
And who were your uncles?
Uncle Monroe Fipes and Lester Robinson.
All right, and that's how you got started, really early.
I was 8 years old.
And did they start you out working on the track, like hot walking or something like that?
They started me out walking horses.
So then, as you proceeded in school, then you got more interested in the horses. Is that right?
I got more interested in the horses. I had to work to support my sisters.
All right. Were you the oldest one?
Yeah, I'm next to the oldest.
Next to the oldest. Were any of your other relatives involved in horse racing?
My father did not involve. I had two uncles.
Two uncles involved. Yeah. Lester was one of them.
Lester Robinson.
And what did Lester do?
He was a groom.
For who? Do you remember
for
who?
For Harry Saladin. He worked for the Buddha Stable. He worked for Jake Lowenstein. Yeah.
So what you would consider a good groom?
He was a good groom.
Yeah, so he taught you the rudiments, the basics of horse racing.
Helped me a lot.
Good. Could you tell us a little bit about your interest and how it bloomed over the years? Did you continue the interest from the time at the old Douglas Park? And how did you continue, and when did you really start officially working for somebody?
I started officially working when I was 16 years old, when I dropped out of school.
And then who did you go with?
I went to work for Mike McGee.
Mike McGee, yeah. And what job did you have?
I was a groom.
Groom.
Yeah.
Started out as a groom.
That's
all right. And then did you travel with the horses?
I traveled when I was 16.
Mike McGee, and where'd you go? Can you remember that experience?
I went to Tropical Park, come back to Churchilldown, then Chicago.
And is that the kind of circuit that you made for a number of years?
Many years.
Like how long then did you go from, how long did you work for Mike McGee?
Maybe 4 or 5 years.
4 or 5 years. And then after Mike McGee, you just went with someone else?
Someone else. Stanley Reeser.
And how long were you with Stanley Reeser?
Maybe 7 or 8 years.
7 or 8 years with Stanley Reeser.
Yeah.
Was that when Poochie was exercising for him?
That's when Poochie was there.
Yeah. And then after Reeser?
I went to work for Jim Padgett.
That's right. That's what I remember, because when I came back here to Louisville, that's when I hooked up. I knew you before then, but then you were working with Padgett.
Yeah, I was assistant trainer for him about 14 or 15 years.
And so you moved up from the groom to the assistant trainer. Is that sort of like the way you go on the backside? You go from hot walker to groom to assistant trainer to trainer. Now you are a trainer, right?
Yeah, I'm a trainer.
How long have you had your trainer's license?
I have my trainer's license in 84.
In 84?
84, 85.
And then when you were assistant trainer for Padgett, did you have your license then?
Yes, I did.
So then you could have trained. Actually, you were really training most of Patrick's horses, yeah. I can remember that.
I was mostly training them, but he's a good fella, and he treated me nice. That's the reason I didn't go no further.
Right. And how long did you stay with Jim Patrick?
Off and on for 14 to 15 years. He got out of business some and went back into business, and I went back to work.
And then he kind of trusted you with the horses. Do you remember how many horses Jim Patrick had?
Well, sometimes we'd have maybe 10 to 12. You know. Sometimes we got down to 6. You know. One time we had 20.
That was the days, those were the days when you had stopped traveling so much, right?
Yeah.
Patrick started localizing, right?
Localizing.
So that was, by the time you started with Patrick, a local right here, you weren't going back and forth to Florida.
Very seldom traveled then. That's when I slowed up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Why did you, kind of stop. Oh, here we go. So the names of those two horses that you had, that Padgett had in the Derby.
Blue Scar and Amano.
And you remember how they did in the Derby?
One of them run third. Blue Scar run third, got beat a half a length, and Amano run fourth.
Well, who was Blue Scar, right? What Derby was that? You remember who won the Derby that year?
I don't remember who won it. I'm trying to.
But he did run third, though, right?
Third in the Derby.
Collected a check then, right?
It was in the 60s.
It was in the 60s.
Yeah.
That's good. Tell me a little bit about what you perceive to be the highlights of your career on the racetrack. Who were some of the good horses you worked around with? Who were some of the good groomed, good jockeys? Just talk a little bit about your experiences.
Well, some of the good horses I've been around, I worked at Stanley Racing. We had some real good fillies. I rubbed horses like Patty Kane, in which she made 400-some thousand back in the 70s, in which she probably made 3 or 4 million now. So she was a good filly. And I rubbed a lot of good horses with Stanley Racing. And I worked for Padgett and ran a lot of good horses. And that's about the best horses I've been around.
When you groom and you rub horses and they good horses like that and win, do you make money on that?
Yeah, you get 1%.
1%?
Yeah, 1%, and sometimes the jockeys stake you. The good jockeys do stake the groom.
Right.
They appreciate it.
So this has been your livelihood then, right?
That's all I ever did.
Yeah.
And I like it a lot.
You're in love with this.
I like it a lot.
Yeah. What do you like about it most, John?
Well, I've been around them all my life. It's like anything you'd be around, you know. It's like, you know, it's been around it all my life since I was 8 years old.
Do you like the animal himself?
I like the animal. I just been around it. It's in my blood.
Yeah. And you don't think there's anything else that you're going to do in the rest of your life, right?
No,
This is going to be it now.
I don't think that I can't change now.
Right. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about it. I noticed I follow it closely, and the reason I wanted to interview you this morning is because you have had some success. I was talking to you the other day, and you were telling me that you're training now for Dr. Coos, and that he was telling you that you had a percentage of being in the money or winning money of just about 80%.
82%.
82%.
The bookkeeper figured it up. You know, I've been working for him about 7 months now.
7 months, and you have an 82%
in the money
percent.
I've been with it.
And that is excellent.
Yeah, he said that's really good.
Now, how many races have you won recently?
Since I've been with him.
Yeah, since you've been with him.
Seven
races.
Yeah.
Most of them at Turfway.
I went 2 at Churchill.
Oh, you won 2 at Churchill last fall.
I was with him last fall.
Now, most of the horses that you're working with now, are these stake horses, or are they claiming horses?
They're claiming horses. He got 2 strings of horses.
And where's the other string?
Mitch Shiroda got the good ones.
Mitch has got the good ones. Where are they?
They at Churchill now. They wasn't Gustin Quark all the way.
How did he do with the good string?
I think he went 1 race there.
So with the bad strain, or the lesser strain, we call it bad strain, yeah. But they're winning. The bad strain is winning, right?
The doctor said the worst horses are doing the best.
Do you how do you attribute that to? What's the secret to your recent success?
Well, care, and I had a lot of good teachers. You know.
Care. Talk a little bit about care.
According to your health, you got to take care of all. You got to feed them right, or know when they need certain things, warm them right. You know, but you got to watch your horse. And your grooms have a lot to do with it. You know, they come tell you certain things that you can't see.
Right.
And that makes a big difference.
Do you think that that's oftentimes overlooked by some of the big boys in racing?
The grooms are the most underpaid person on the track.
And they really know more about the horse than anybody, right?
They with them 16 hours a day. The trainers are 5 minutes.
Right.
Yeah.
And
some
trainers listen, right?
Yeah, but some trainers appreciate the grooms.
Right.
But a lot of them don't.
Yeah.
You know.
Is that, and we'll talk a little bit about African Americans on the racetrack. And of course, we know that African Americans started this industry.
Yeah.
At the beginnings, the leading jockeys and the trainers and all that were African Americans. And then for a while, you didn't see any jockeys and you didn't see any trainers. How do you see the plight of African Americans now on the racetrack?
Well, it's very few around. It's very few around. You know, look like the game, they almost out of the game.
Yeah.
But it's hard for us back here. You know what I mean? It's hard. You know, you don't get the credit you deserve. I don't care what you do.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get the credit, you know.
And why do you think that? Is that racism?
It's some back here. You know, I mean, they may not show it to your friends, but you can see it. It's
right
in there, you know. Like, I've been successful with this man, you know, and people seem like they're jealous of me.
Well, of course, yeah. That's always the case, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that in, inside the group and outside too? Is the people
in and out?
Right. Some African Americans are jealous too, right?
Yeah, they're jealous.
When you start winning because they are down so low, have been oppressed so much themselves, and you start seeing winning, then they start. It's almost like being like crabs in a barrel, right?
You know, I have paid my dues. I've been with horses 40 years.
40 years?
Yeah, that was since I was 10. I'm 51 years old now.
So you've been around the racetrack 40 years.
Maybe 40 or 41. I should
That's
know
amazing.
Something.
That's amazing. Well, you know, I know you know.
Yeah, so I should know something about it. You know, I've been around some good trainers. I worked around some good grooms, and I learned and watched.
Who is the best teacher? Who has been your best teacher over the years?
A fellow named James Theodore Crawford, which they call him Tommy Long.
Tommy Long.
He helped me a lot.
Yeah, and I've interviewed Tommy Long before he passed away last summer. All of us who've been around the racetrack had a great love for Tommy Long.
He was a good horse.
Yeah, one of the best, right?
Yeah, he was a good horse.
I remember before he died, Amos and a couple of them in these little small whiskey bottles had a little ointment like they called it the Tommy Long.
Yeah, he made it up himself.
what was that?
It was some kind of brace he made up himself, and he sold it around the track.
And you put that on the legs?
On the legs. Yeah. I don't know what was in it, but he made it himself.
I asked him about that before he died. In fact, I have it on the tape. I asked him to give me the recipe,
but he never would
give you the recipe.
Yeah.
He just knew it was good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tommy Long was around the racetrack something like 70 years.
Yeah, at least.
And that was his life also, right?
Yeah, when I was a little kid, he used to carry me back for the track too. But I couldn't be around my uncles because they had jobs.
Right.
They would carry me over, and with Tommy Long, I would go walk horses with him. And, you know, that was where I spent a lot of my time when I was young with him.
You know, what you say about Tommy, I've asked other people about that, and they've all said to me that Tommy was the teacher also.
Yeah.
He was a teacher. He didn't mind sitting down and going through the rudiments of horse races and all that.
He helped a lot of us youngsters that were on the track. You know, all you had to do was watch him, and he did the old way of doing it, you know, and which is, I mean, that was the best way.
Oh, yeah.
If they didn't have no machines, because the horse gets sick, you had to groom or had to take care of himself. You know, they didn't call no veterinarians then.
Yeah.
If we have a colic or which is stomach ache, you had to take care of yourself, but now you call the veterinarian.
Yeah. But you know how to do all of that then, right?
I know how to do all that.
So in other words, Tommy, in some ways, was a veterinarian without license, right?
Yeah, he was a jack of all trades with the horses.
Yeah, had everything, yeah, right?
He knows something about any area about the horse.
And in my young days, I'm a little older than you are, I'm 65. I remember Tommy around the Church of Downs. He was an exercise boy at the time, right?
I wasn't around him then. You
weren't around him then. Yeah. But when you knew him then, he was just booming.
In the 50s.
Yeah. He was booming mainly.
Yeah.
Well, that's great, because I wanted to highlight that to make sure that the listener understands the importance of a good teacher, because that's really, and someone who's willing to learn, like you've been willing to learn, and then you're not so arrogant about it that you don't give credit to people who helped you along the way. Of all the people that you've seen on the backside exercising horses, who are some of the best exercise boys? Who would you consider to be the best that you've seen?
Well, you know, the real name?
Yes.
Was Poochie, which they called Simpson. There was a fellow named Blackburn, which I never know his name. It was all black. You know, there was black exercise boys. They was really good. A fellow worked for Dixie Animal Farm named Monk.
Yep, I remember him.
Yeah, he was good. And there was another fellow that worked for Dixie Island, which they called Sox. They was all nicknames. I never did know their names, but it was a lot of black.
But you watched them exercise,
yeah,
there
was a lot of black exercise boys around. Was really good.
Why do you think that the exercise boys, who were really good exercise boys, could they have been riders, some of them?
Yeah, they could have been riders.
Blackburn, of course, was a rider.
Yeah, he rode.
Yeah. But at that particular time when he rode, that was a time when blacks weren't... They were going out of jockeying, right?
They were going out of jockeying.
Right. And so some of the best riders, really, were the exercise boys in the morning, right?
Exercise boys have got a lot to do with training horses. If they don't... A lot of things they can feel that you can't see standing on the ground.
What about the exercise boys now as compared to the exercise boys?
It's no comparison.
What do you say?
That's up there. You know, they can exercise. Or you might find one out of 10 that can come tell you something. The rest of them just get your money and come back. All they know, they say it went good. You know, but you know, if they can't tell you nothing about the horse, they no good to you.
Yeah.
All of them don't go good.
Yeah, so all of what they're doing. So you try to pick out a good exercise boy.
Got to have a good exercise boy, a good blacksmith, and good grooms. That makes a difference in training horses.
Do you see a disappearance of black exercise boys now?
You can count them on one hand in Kentucky.
Is that right?
You can count them on one hand.
Even right out here at Sports Spectrum.
Yeah. It's one black at the Sports Spectrum.
One.
No, it's two. Sam Alexander and Sonny Cole. It's two out here.
And who are the rest of them? Women?
Women, Hispanic, Mexicans, you know.
And so the caliber, the quality of the exercise boy has gone down.
Yeah, it's 600 horses stable at the Sports Spectrum, and it's two black exercise boys here.
That shows you the demise, the disappearance of blacks and exercise. What about black grooms?
They have got short.
I mean, short on them also.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people hire Mexicans because they work cheap, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, over
many of these are illegal aliens.
Yes, a lot of them. You know, like the first of the when the immigration people come around, a lot of them have to leave here.
Yeah. Because in other words, the horsemen hire these people because they get them for less, right?
They get them for less pay. Yeah.
But the reality is that when they get them for less pay, then you're getting less quality. Yeah, right.
You get less quality. But nowadays they don't groom horses like they used to groom them years ago.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, some people, you know, you still got some good people to take care of your horses, right? But nowadays, all they do is they shake the stalls, they give them a bath, and don't pay much attention to their legs or much attention to their blood and hair and stuff, you know. Years ago, they wormed horses every 30 days.
Yeah.
But now, you know, all they want somebody to do is come in and shake the stall and keep the horse clean. You know? I mean, it's not like it used to be.
How do you view the... usage of drugs on the racetrack, like butazolidine and Lasix, and I see sometimes a lot of the horses, even maidens who never started before, they start them out on Lasix. What do you think about that?
I don't think it's a good program, because when I come around, they didn't have this. You know, if a horse needed, I could see, but people that's first time started, a horse never raced, and they, They're getting the medication. I don't see no reason why. You know, I can't see reason why. Yeah. I wouldn't do it.
But there are people who do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people just give them laces and do it because it's legal.
And so they, does that make them run better?
No. No, it don't help. It don't help nothing. Laces is hard on the horse.
Is that right?
Yeah, when you get horse laces, it takes all the fluid out of their body. And which a lot of people don't know how to use laces. They take all the fluid out of the body and you got to put it back in.
That's right.
The next day or two after horse racing laces, you got to give them plenty of electrolytes to put the fluid back in. And which a lot of people don't do that, and a lot of horses race dehydrated.
Right.
You know, if you keep getting horses laces and don't put the fluid back in, they're dehydrated, and that's no good. They're not going to run like
that. And of course, that means and then they run horses right back quicker now than they used to, right?
That is bad.
Yeah.
That is so bad.
What do you think a good time for running a horse back from a race? Like you went with Crafty or Moore Sunday.
3 weeks.
3 weeks,
yeah,
right?
That's close enough.
And in between the 3 weeks, what will you do with
him? Well, I fresh him up. Sometimes I get him plenty of electrolyte. You know, I walk him and train him and graze him, you know, and just take my time with him because he's already fit to race.
Right.
And then like when I before I get ready to run him, I might breeze him a slow half, like a half and 49 or something, you know.
Right.
He's ready to run, you know, he don't need all that.
But resting him up is important though, right?
Yeah, but owners get in the hurry with horses. They hurt trainers, you know, they want to run him back soon to see a race, and which that's no good.
Yeah.
And years ago when I come around, the horses didn't race year round. They might race 6 months out, you rest six, you know. And that's the reason the horses all break down and stuff now.
Now, as we look to the future, what do you see the future of African Americans, blacks, in racing to be?
Maybe year 2000, it's going to be very slim for us.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's going to be very slim for us. You know, the way it's going now, it's fading out so fast now, you can't always see nothing now. You know, you can't always see nothing now.
That's been the focus of a lot of my interviews, to try to figure out, what is the reason behind this?
I wonder about it myself. Years ago when I come around, like they used to bring them youngsters around, youngsters would come around and walk horses before they go to school.
Right. But
now they won't come around. They had people like Tommy Long would put four or five of us on the back of his truck and carry us to the farm and carry us to the racetrack. But now that don't happen. You know,
you think that what's happening in society has a lot to do with it?
It's got a lot to do with it.
That the youngsters themselves and their parents.
Yeah.
Aren't pushing them towards work, because to be on the racetrack is to be a worker. You have to work, right?
Yeah.
Got to get up early in the morning. What time do you get up every morning?
4:30. I'm at work at 5.
And you work from 5 to 9 or 10, and then come back and feed and all. So you got to be willing to put some hours in. Is that right?
Some hours in.
And then you think that that among our young people, especially young blacks, that the work ethic is not as stringent as it was back in your day when you were coming along?
Yeah, well, what it is, the youngsters get a lot of free stuff they shouldn't get, you know. We had to work when we came up. We had to work, you know, to survive. You know, I wanted to work.
So the kids like in South Louisville that we know, you know, and the kids walking the street and selling drugs and stuff, they look at fun. That's a kind of easy way out there.
Yeah, that's the easy way.
And it's hard to entice them away from that into the horse race.
Because the money's so easy.
Yeah.
They stand on the corner and make $100 in 15, 20 minutes.
Right.
You know.
And you come out here and you can hardly, what do they pay a groom now?
Well, my grooms have a good job. They make $350 per week, but that's the top job.
Oh, that's top.
Yeah. But you know, a lot of them just rub three horses, $250, but my grooms, I get $350 a week.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Plus they get
you get benefits too?
Yeah, we insure.
Got insured.
Yeah, Dr. Coots has insurance on it, and liability and workman's comp.
What do you think about the advent of the top entertainers and pop musicians and people like MC Hammer and Berry Gordy and those kind of people? Have they had an impact on horse racing?
I mean, what they did, I definitely couldn't approve of. They bought horses and never did give a black a chance. You know, I definitely didn't approve of that.
Yeah, you and I have talked about that. In fact, I have it on another tape with Mr. Elmer Clark about the entertainers and the football stars or athletes who have a lot of money,
yeah,
many of whom have invested money in horse racing. A friend of mine is Magic Johnson, and a few years ago, I've known him since he was a little kid. A few years ago, he went in with the hockey star Wayne Gretzky, and they put up $100,000. And I went to the Magic and asked him the question, well, why would you invest some money in a horse you didn't even know about it? He said, well, Gretzky told me that was a good deal, and I just got into it. Do you think that there's a way for people like yourself and people like Amos and Beetlebum, William Doyle, and people like that, is there a way for them to come to somebody that's got money and talk to them about if they're interested in investing? Is there a bridge to be crossed here?
I don't think they would do it. If I was to go to a man where I got a deal for you with $100,000, I don't think they would do it.
Is that because of the feeling that blacks are not as good in the horse industry as whites?
Well, they are good as whites, and some are better. But what it is, they never get the chance. If you don't have the horse to work with, you can't produce. Like this is, I worked under a lot of people, and I got a lot of credit, like system training with Fagg. I got a lot of credit because he paid me good. But this is, I have had horses to my own, which is the first time I really have got the break.
This is the first time?
Yeah.
In 40 years?
Yeah, I worked under people for years, but they know I did the training, but this is the first time I really had a break, and I've been really successful for the man.
And back to what I perceive to be the truth, and that is, even though you have the knowledge and the experience and the background, there's still people who won't entrust their horses to you,
yeah,
because they feel that you're not as qualified as somebody like Wayne Lucas,
that's
for
right.
example, right?
So that's the way it is.
Yeah, so Wayne Lucas has got the name,
yeah,
but John Lee Robinson does not have the name.
Yeah.
Wayne Lucas happens to be white,
yeah,
and has got all the contacts, but you don't have those kinds of contacts, and so then you get locked out.
Yeah, you never get a break because the blacks that have money will not trust you. You know, they will not buy a good horse to get
you.
We're going again, and I'll try to erase that part. But I wanted to get into some of the, as we close down this interview this morning, it's been a very, very good interview. I wanted to get from you your perception as to how we can attract more black people into horse racing.
It's very hard because the blacks do not trust another black with their money. You know, I mean, it's hard to believe. I mean, they will not trust another black. I have been to people that have got plenty of money in Louisville and try to explain to them where they pay a lot of taxes and they could get in the business, have some fun, you might win some money, set up a syndication, 4 or 5 y'all. I mean, they thought I was crazy, you know. I thought I was gonna try to beat them out of something, you know. They'd rather pay the tax people a couple $100,000 a year instead of might get lucky, have some fun. That's being a lot of whites in the business, they're in for the write-off.
Yeah.
And they get lucky and get a good horse and have some fun.
Yeah, I know a friend of mine, I won't call his name, but he's quite a successful businessman in town.
Yeah.
And he invested some money in a horse, and of course the horse was being trained by Bill Mott, and it was up in the 100,000, and the horse then hurt himself, and now he's out on the farm and not even racing.
Yeah.
But that same fella, if you went to him and said, look, and there are people in Louisville who have money, and he's one of them.
Yeah.
If you went to him and laid it out for him and said, look, Mr. So-and-so, I have, you know, I got this record. Now, you got a record now. I mean, you know, not only do you have the name, you've always been known for me as being someone who's very knowledgeable. But now you can say, I got the record. Now, you think still you would get that kind of reception?
He tell me that I'll talk to you another time. That's what he would say.
But you know, that's back
then. Probably wouldn't even look at my record. He said, I'll talk to you another time.
That's back to that old adage that I've often used in some of my speeches, and that is that there are blacks who have a mentality that I think grows out of slavery, and that is that even the white man's ice is colder than the black man's ice. I tell a story sometimes about a black man and a white man who was selling ice. in a community back when I was growing up. And the black man had an ice truck, and the white man had an ice truck, and the black man had to go out of business because the blacks thought that the white man's ice was colder than the black man's ice.
That's the same way the racism is. It's really hard to get a break. You know, if the black
and so it comes from the, on one hand it comes from the white, and on the other hand it comes from the black. So you kind of call it a double bind.
A bind in this kind of game.
Yeah.
So they a lot of people waiting for the write off, and the blacks rather give the government a lot of money. You know, instead of getting a chest read, I never had a break.
Yeah.
Because you know it's the distrust in everybody. If you don't think you're out or not.
Well, I don't have a whole lot of money, but I invested a little bit of something last year in a horse, and you know. I see, and this is the way I look at it, that if someone who had money, you know, and if you're talking about developing black businesses and economic development, that syndication among blacks, say the Dr. Marshall, myself, and a few others who really are into horses, would pool our money, come up with a good stable, bring somebody like you and some other folks along as our trainers. There's a possibility for making money.
That's a good idea. I mean, if you could get something like it set up and a lot of four or five people interested in it, that'd be a good idea. I worked for Paget. That's how he did. They started syndication, which was a Centurion. Five doctors got in it, and they were really successful. They put up enough money, bought three horses, and left the money in the pool to pay the bills.
You know?
I mean, they were really successful. And which some fellas in it, they had plenty of money. They said, well, if I lose $20,000, some, you know, I won't have to pay Uncle Sam anyway.
That's right.
Yeah.
You write it off.
Yeah, write it off.
Yeah.
You know, so they were successful in the business with the horses they bought.
You've been in the business 40 years now, and you're not even 60 years old. You're not even 55.
So 51.
51. And so what do you look to in the future for yourself in horse racing?
I just want to be a trainer, and I would like to win some big races. I had a lot of people told the man I work for now, Dr. Cousy was telling him the other day, he told him like that, said, you got the best man on the backside working for you. He said, y'all just leave him alone. So you're really doing good. He said, you better leave him alone before he leaves. Because you got the best fellow on the backside. There's a fellow was standing there telling him that. He said, just leave him alone.
And of course, yeah. Coots is one that has some trust in you now.
Yeah. He was in the Centurion when I worked for Patrick.
How did you get involved with Dr. Coots?
Well, he was in the Centurion of syndication when I was assistant trainer for Paget.
This last time?
He approached me.
Is that right?
Yeah, he approached me, asked me would I like to go to work for him. I was working for Gary Sims.
Right. In fact, you trained Gary Sims.
He got a suspension, and I went some races with him. He come to me, I worked with Gary Sims, and asked me, I said, Doc, I have a good job. I said, the only way I could go to work for you would be on a salary, which I didn't have the bankroll to start out on new stable, buy feed and pay my help and get work from the comp and insurance. He said, well, that's all right. I said, how much you got to have? I named the figure. He said, that's no problem. And I've been with him ever since.
And I see you got some of my friends around you here, Clinton and
Wilbur Jones.
Jones.
Called him Paul Joe.
Paul Joe. Oh, you got some of the best help, right?
Yeah, I got
right?
Some good help.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's wonderful. And I thank you for your interview this morning, and hopefully your future will be bright.
Yeah.
I'm very, very happy to see you have success. I'm one person who thinks that if you got having success, then that means I'm going to have success. And that means everybody, you know, I mean, you cannot continue in a business like this without boosting up people, pushing them up. And that's why I always see you, whenever I see you and you win a race or something, I always say, congratulations, I'm happy for you.
Yeah. I enjoy it very much because they really think the blacks are not able to train on. I mean, that's the way it is back here.
But we have it in our blood. It comes from our, not only the history, we know that it comes out of our history.
A lot of people said that I never had a break. They're glad for me. They know that I should have been had a break a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I just wouldn't been over.
Well, you're not the type to bend over.
I'm not going
to
bend over.
That's right.
You know,
you're proud.
If I'd have been years ago, I might have had a lot of us, but I wasn't going to bend like it.
But and you've seen that there are some blacks who do bend over,
they
right?
They do bend over. I'm not going to do it.
And I don't, you know, I can't, I that's why I admire you.
I pick up aluminum cans.
Thanks much. That's the end of our interview with John Lee Robinson, and thank you very much.